This isn't safe. It's absurd.
We gave our oath, General, said Anastasia solemnly.
To the Persian Emperor himself, added Valentinian, trying and failing quite miserably to look suitably lugubrious. Belisarius glared at both of them, then transferred the glare onto the enemy some distance away. Quite some distance away. Belisarius, along with Anastasius and Valentinian, was standing on top of the huge pile of stones which the Kushans had dug out of the Nahar Malka. The Syrian infantrymen who defended that man-made hill had constructed an observation platform from which Belisarius could watch the progress of the battle. They had also built a narrow, winding road, more of a path, really, which led up to the summit from the protected northern side of the rock pile. As a vantage point from which to observe the battle, Belisarius could find no fault with the thing. Even without his telescope, the rock hill's elevation gave him an excellent view of the enemy's dispositions on the south side of the Euphrates and the Nahar Malka. The telescope enabled him to pick out even small details of the enemy's formations. But, God damn it, he growled. I'm too far away. By the time a courier gets up here and back again, the way to ride a horse up that so-called road, I might as well have given orders for yesterday's breakfast. It's safe, insisted Aide. Before Belisarius could make a reply, one of the Malwa rockets fired at the Roman troops defending the dam below veered wildly off course. For a moment it seemed as if the missile was heading directly for the rock pile, close enough, at least, that Valentinian and Anastasius began to take cover behind the low wall surrounding the platform. Growling with satisfaction, Belisarius stood as erect as possible.
Get down! Get down!
Belisarius, sarcastically.
Safe, remember? Safe, you said.
And in truth, safe it was. With typical unpredictability, the rocket suddenly swerved to the east. A few seconds later, it exploded harmlessly over the middle of the Nahar Malka. Wisely, Aide refrained from comment. Belisarius took a deep breath, controlling his temper. There was no point in trying to force the issue at the moment. Valentinian and Anastasius were obviously ready and willing to enforce a strict compliance with their vow to Emperor Khusrow. For that matter, all of Belisarius's officers had made clear their own agreement with Khusrow's position. Belisarius had been shocked, actually, when he realized how adamant his commanders were that he stay out of the direct line of fire in the coming battle.
There's no need for you in the front line, sir, Agathias had argued at the command meeting on the eve of the battle. No need and a lot to be lost if you're killed or injured. This is just going to be a slugging match, at least in the beginning.
On that point, Agathias had been correct. It was late afternoon, and the battle had been raging for hours. The Malwa had made their first probes at dawn on both sides of the Euphrates. Encountering the large body of Persians guarding Ormazd's camp on the south bank, the Malwa had early on decided to take a purely defensive stance there. They were obviously more than happy to let Ormazd and his 20,000 heavy cavalry sit on the sidelines, while they concentrated their attack on the Roman forces. Those Roman forces would have been their principal target in any event. It was the Romans, not Ormazd's Persians, who were forted up on the dam across the Euphrates. It was the Romans also who were positioned to guard the dam from any attack coming up the Nahar Malka. A slugging match the first day, with the Romans in position to outslug the Malwa. The defensive position of Belisarius's army was excellent. With the desert to the west and Ormazd's 20,000 lancers encamped on the south bank of the Euphrates, the Malwa had no choice but to advance up the riverbed and along the narrow strip of land between the Euphrates and the Nahar Malka. As that strip of land approached the point where the royal canal branched directly east from the east by southeast flowing Euphrates, it narrowed down to a mere spit. The tip of that triangle was guarded by well-built Roman fieldworks, complete with timber brought all the way down the Euphrates by barges. Buttressed with rocks and tamped earth, the walls of that palisade were guarded by Syrian dragoons. When needed, the dragoons were backed up by all of the Constantinople cataphracts ready to sally at a moment's notice, which they had over and over again as the day wore on, waiting until the Syrians had worn out another Malwa assault before driving them back in defeat. Nor could the enemy outflank the fieldworks to the east. To do so would require crossing the rapid flow of the Nahar Malka in the face of another Roman barrier. The giant pile of rocks on the north bank of the Royal Canal, which the Kushans had excavated, had been turned into an impromptu fortress, anchoring the Roman left flank. More Syrian troops were stationed on that rock pile under the command of Kutsis, along with the Kalinicum garrison. So far, those soldiers had had an easy day. The Malwa had not yet made any attempt to cross the Nahar Malka and attack the dam from the north bank of the Royal Canal. They had concentrated their efforts on the dam itself, especially its eastern anchor, trying to hammer their way to victory. Yes, on that point, Belisarius couldn't argue. The first day was a slugging match, nothing else, just as Agathias had predicted. And it was true the general would have been able to play no particularly useful role on those front lines. But Belisarius knew that wouldn't last. The Romans weren't facing the normal run of Malwa generals here. He had seen with his telescope the arrival of a howdah-bearing elephant with the enemy's army. A small mob of servants had been splashing that howdah with pails of water drawn from the river, a crude but effective way of cooling the howdah's interior. Link itself was here. He was as certain of it as he was of his own name. I must get closer, he thought to himself. Soon enough, this simple slugging match of Agathias's is going to start unraveling. I must be closer. Suddenly, hearing a change in the distant shouts of the enemy's forces, Belisarius cocked his head. The battle was so far away that he found himself forced to rely on his hearing as much as his eyesight. We're beating off the attack, he said. Anastasius and Valentinian copied his stance, listening with the trained ear of veterans. I think you're right, agreed Valentinian. Anastasius nodded, then asked, What's that make? 5 assaults? 4, replied Belisarius. That first one, just after dawn, was more in the way of a reconnaissance. There'd been only 4 mass charges. Crazy bastards, sneered Valentinian. Do they really think they can hammer their way onto that dam without siege guns? Jesus, that must be a slaughter down there. The onagers and scorpions would be bad enough backed up by Boozies and his dragoons, but they gotta face Morris and the Illyrians, too. He gave his general an approving glance. That was a great idea, that road you had the Kushans build. Belisarius smiled crookedly. I can't take credit for it, I'm afraid. I stole the idea from Nebuchadrezzar. Inspired by the design of Babylon's fortifications, Belisarius had ordered a road built just behind the crest of the dam. A stone wall had then been hastily erected on the very crest. The road and the wall were jury-rigged, to be sure. The road was just wide enough and sturdy enough to allow the Thracian and Illyrian cataphracts to rush to any part of the dam which was under heavy attack. The wall was just thick enough and just high enough to shelter them from most missile fire. At the same time, it allowed the mounted archers to shoot their own bows over the wall at the Malwa soldiers trying to slog their way forward. Combined with the torsion artillery mounted all along the dam and the dismounted Syrians' archery and grenades, the result had been murderous. Most of the enemy troops had been forced to charge the dam up the riverbed of the Euphrates. Not only did that muddy terrain slow them down, but it also broke up the cohesion of their formations. The Euphrates hadn't dried up completely. The dam had diverted most of its water into the Nahar Malka, but there was still enough seeping through to produce a network of small streams and pools. Eventually, those streams converged and produced a small river, but not for several miles. Below the dam itself, the riverbed was an attacker's nightmare. Mud, reeds, sinkholes, pools, creeks. As far as possible, the Malwa had concentrated their efforts against the eastern end of the dam. There, the enemy troops could advance along the dry land which had once been the left bank of the Euphrates. But Belisarius had expected that, which is why he'd positioned the Constantinople troops on that end of the dam, backed up by the Katyusha rockets. He'd spent the night before the battle with Agathias and his men, exhorting them to stand fast. The Greeks, he explained, were the anchor of the entire defensive line. They would take the heaviest blows, but so long as they held, the enemy couldn't prevail. When Belisarius finished, they gave him a cheer and vowed to hold the line. Hold it they had through 4 savage assaults. But they had driven back each charge and added their own heavy charges onto the enemy's butcher bill. The sounds of the battle were fading rapidly now. It was obvious that the Malwa were retreating. Within a minute, Belisarius could see streams of enemy soldiers retreating from the dam. They were bearing large numbers of the wounded with them, chased on their way by rocket volleys fired from the Katyushas. Belisarius glanced up at the sky. The sun was beginning to set. There'll be a night attack, he predicted. A mass assault all across the line. He pointed to the eastern anchor. The crunch will come there. Count on it.
Agathias will hold them, said Anastasius confidently. Come what may, Agathias will hold.
Valentinian grunted his agreement. Belisarius glared at the distant enemy, then glared at his bodyguards. If he could have turned his eyes inside out, he would have glared at Aid.
I'm too far away, he roared.
The attack began 2 hours after dusk, and it lasted halfway through the night. The worst of it, as Belisarius had predicted, came on the eastern anchor of the dam. Hour after hour, the general spent perched on his cursed observation platform, leaning over the wall, straining to hear what he could. Cursing Khusrow, cursing Valentinian and Anastasius, cursing Aid. He got a little sleep in the early hours of the dawn after the enemy assault had been clearly beaten off. At daybreak, Valentinian awakened him. A courier is coming, announced the cataphract. Belisarius scrambled to his feet and went over to the side of the platform where the path came up from below. Peering down, he could see an armored man making his laborious way up that narrow, twisting trail through the rocks.
I think that's Morris, said Anastasius.
Startled, Belisarius looked closer. He'd been expecting one of the young cataphracts whom Morris had been using to keep the general informed of the battle's progress, not the Kiliarch himself. But it was Morris, sure enough. Belisarius stiffened, feeling a chill in his heart. Valentinian verbalized his thought.
Bad news, he announced. Sure as taxes. Only reason Morris would come himself.
As soon as Morris made his way to the crest, Belisarius reached down and hauled him over the wall. What's wrong? He asked immediately. From the sound, I thought they'd been beaten off again.
They were, grunted Morris.
He took off his heavy helmet and heaved a sigh of relief.
God, it's like being in a furnace. Forgotten what fresh air tastes like.
God damn it, Morris, what's wrong? The Kiliarch's gray eyes met Belisarius's brown ones, squarely, unflinchingly, sternly.
The same thing that's usually wrong in a battle, whether it's going well or not. We're hammering the bloody shit out of them, sure, but they get to hammer back. We've taken heavy casualties, especially the Greeks.
Morris drew in a long, deep breath.
Timatius is dead. He led the Illyrians in a charge against some Malwa, Kushan's worse luck, who made it over the wall. Horse got hamstrung and gutted, and...
Morris shrugged, not bothering to elaborate. There were few things in a battle as certain as the fate of an armored cavalryman brought down by infantry. Timatius wouldn't have survived 10 seconds after hitting the ground.
Liberius? Asked Belisarius.
He's taken command of the Illyrians, replied Morris. He's doing a good job, too. He organized the counterattack that drove the Kushans back down the dam.
Belisarius studied Morris's grim face. He felt his chill deepen. Morris hadn't climbed all the way up that hill just to tell him that a dull, dim-witted commander had been succeeded by a more capable subordinate.
I'm sorry about Timatius, he said softly.
He was a reliable man, if nothing else. His family will get his full pension. I'll see to it. But that's not what you came here to tell me, so spit it out. The grizzled Thracian wiped his face wearily.
It's Agathias.
Damn, hissed Belisarius. There was a real anguish in that hiss, and the three cataphracts who heard it understood that it was the pain of a man losing a treasured friend, not a general losing an excellent officer.
Damn, he repeated, very softly.
Morris shook his head.
He's not dead, General, grimacing. Not quite, anyway, but he's lost one leg for sure, and I don't know as how he'll still be alive tomorrow.
What happened?
Morris swiveled, staring back at the dam.
They really pushed hard this time, especially at the eastern anchor. Solid Yetai, that was, fighting on their own, not just chivying Malwa regulars.
Still looking to the southwest, the Kiliarch muttered an incoherent curse.
They're mean, tough, gutsy bastards, I'll give them that. I don't even want to think how many casualties they took before they finally broke through.
He turned back to Belisarius.
The Syrian dragoons couldn't hold them, so Agathias led a lance charge. In pitch dark. Can you believe it? Man's got brass balls, I swear he does. That broke the Yeti, crushed him, but he got hit by a grenade blast. Took off his right leg clean, just above the knee. Mangled his left foot, too. It'll have to be amputated, I think. Beyond that, he shrugged. Shrapnel tore him up pretty fierce. He's lost a lot of blood. Get him off the dam, commanded Belisarius. He turned and pointed to the small fleet of barges anchored in the middle of the Euphrates about a mile to the north. Get him to one of the ambulance barges. Morris rubbed his face. That's not going to be easy. He's still conscious, believe it or not. A half-wondering, half-admiring chuckle. Still wants to fight, even. When I left the dam, he was yelling at the doctor to tie up the one leg and cut off the fucking useless foot on the other so he could get back on a horse. Valentinian and Anastasius laughed. Belisarius couldn't help smiling himself. Hit him over the head if you have to, Morris, but I want him out of there. Again, he pointed to the barges. There's better medical care available in the ambulance barges. And his wife's on one of those boats, too. I don't know which one, but I'll find out. She'll probably be more help keeping him alive than anyone else. Morris's eyes widened. His wife? Sudaba's here? What in the world is that young girl doing on a battlefield? That's the craziest... He broke off, remembering. Belisarius's own wife, Antonina, had had the habit of accompanying her husband on campaign also, all the way to the battlefield. Belisarius clasped Morris's shoulder firmly. I want him alive, Morris. Get him out of here, now. Put Cyril in command of... Already done it, gruffed Morris. Belisarius nodded, took a deep breath. All right. What else? The Kiliarch scowled. Strangely, the expression cheered Belisarius up. Morris, scowling morosely, meant a problem, which was not the same thing as bad news. They're going to change tactics, Morris announced. Even the Malwa won't keep throwing troops away like this forever. They might, countered Belisarius mildly, if they think they're wearing us down fast enough. Morris shook his head. They're not. We're taking pretty heavy casualties, sure, but we're giving out 4 or 5 to every 1 we take. At that rate, attrition will chew them up before it does us. His scowl darkened. And I'm sure they know it, too. I'll tell you something, General. Whoever's running the show on their side is no fool. The frontal attacks have been beaten off, but that's because the terrain favors us and we're on the defensive. The attacks themselves have been organized and directed as good as you could ask, given that god-awful riverbed they have to plow through. There's been none of their usual cocksure stupidity, thinking they can roll over everybody just with their numbers. Yetai and Kushans have been leading every attack, and the Malwa regulars have been backing them up the way they should. A thought came instantly from Aid. Link. Link itself is here. I know, replied Belisarius. Morris was shaking his head again. They've tried the straight-up tactic to see if it would work, pressed it home hard. But now that we've proven to them that they can't just roll over us, they'll try a flank attack, I'm sure of it. Belisarius scratched his chin, nodded. I'm not going to argue the point, Morris. As it happens, I agree with you. He glanced across the river. Upstream of the dam, just before the river diverted into the narrower channel of the Nahar Malka, the Euphrates was still a mile wide. But he could see the Persian camp where Ormazd's army had fought it up throughout the day's battle. Any sign of movement over there? He asked. Morris snorted. About as much as a crocodile wading in the reeds. The only thing moving over there is Ormazd's nostrils taking in the sweet air of opportunity. Belisarius smiled. Well, unless they want to hammer away at 20,000 Dagans, that only leaves the Malwa one other option. Morris grimaced skeptically. He turned and pointed down the slope to the Nahar Malka. Do you have any idea how hard it would be for them to get across? The Nahar Malka's no shallow, placid river like the Euphrates was, General. It's narrower and deeper. The water's moving through there fast, and there aren't any fords within 4 days' march. They'll have to build a pontoon bridge using those little barges they've got a few miles downriver. He turned back, shaking his head. Malkutsis and his boys on this rock pile piss pain all over them, and the Katyushas come up to the riverbank and fire rockets at point-blank range, And me and Cyril and Liberius bring up all the cataphracts to hammer whichever poor bastards do manage to stagger across a rickety little pontoon bridge.
He jerked his head, pointing with his face at Ormazd's camp.
Personally, I'd rather take on the Dagons. If the Malwa can clear the right bank of the Euphrates, they can move upstream and cross back over damn near anywhere. We'd be trapped here, have to abandon the dam and race back to Piroz-Shapur, join forces with Karush and try to hold out a siege.
Belisarius' smile was very crooked.
Morris glared at him. Are you really that sure of yourself? He demanded.
Belisarius made a mollifying gesture with his hands, a gentle little patting motion. Morris wasn't mollified.
What's that? He demanded. Soothing the savage beast, or just petting the dog?
Belisarius left off the motion, then, grinning, yes, Morris, I am that sure of myself. So sure, in fact, that I'm going to predict exactly how this next attack is going to happen. He pointed down the slope of the rock pile to the Nahar Maka below. I predict they'll start building their pontoon bridge today in the late afternoon. The attack will begin after dark. You know why?
So they might have a chance of getting across the bridge, snorted Morris. Never do it in daylight.
Belisarius shook his head. No, that's not why. He gave Morris a hard stare.
You say they've had Yetai and Kushans leading every attack.
Morris nodded. Not this next one, Morris. You watch.
Malwa regulars is all you'll see crossing that pontoon bridge, or would see if it weren't dark. The reason they're going to attack at night is so that we can't see that none of their Yetai or Kushans are participating in the assault. Those troops, he turned his head nodding toward the river, will be crossing over the right bank of the Euphrates about a mile downstream from the dam. Out of our sight, especially since we'll be preoccupied with the attack on the Nahar Malka. By dawn, just when we think we've beaten off another assault, the Malwa army's best troops will come at us from behind. Like you said, they can find any number of places to ford the Euphrates upstream.
Morris's scowl was ferocious now.
You can't be positive the Ormazd will pull out and give them that opening, he protested.
Belisarius shrugged.
Positive? No, but I'll bet long odds on it, Morris. Ormazd knows that the only loyal Persian troops Khusro has up here are Barasmanus and Karush's 10,000. They're forted up at Piroz-Shapur. I wish they were here, grumbled the Kiliarch. We could use them. Don't be stupid. If they were here, Piroz-Shapur would be a pile of ashes. As it is, the Malwa expedition had to skirt the town and leave troops to guard against a sally. Just sitting in Piroz-Shapur, Karush is a threat to them.
He waved his hand. But let's not change the subject. To go back to Ormazd, this is his best chance to move against Khusro. If the Malwa destroy us here, they'll return to Babylon. Keep Khusro penned up while Ormazd takes over all of northern Mesopotamia. The only thing that kept him from doing that before was our intervention, that and our victory at Anatha. If we're gone, he's got a clear hand.
How's he going to explain that to his Dagons? Demanded Morris.
Belisarius laughed.
How else? Blame it on us. Stupid idiot Romans insisted on a hopeless stand. Fortunately, he was too wise to waste his men's lives defending a canal which was obviously just a Roman scheme to reinvade Persia like they did in Julian's day. That's pretty torturous reasoning, muttered Morris, shaking his head.
Again, Belisarius barked a laugh.
Of course it is. So what? It'll serve the purpose.
Morris was still shaking his head.
Not if you're wrong, Morris growled. Damn it, I hate tricky battle plans.
Belisarius smiled.
If I'm wrong, Morris, so what? In that case, Ormazd will have to fight the Malwa who crossed the Euphrates. They may defeat him, but after fighting 20,000 Dagons, I don't think they'll be in any shape to hit us on the flank, do you?
Morris said nothing, then sighed heavily.
All right, we'll see how it goes.
The Kiliarch started to turn away. Belisarius restrained him with a hand on his shoulder.
Wait a moment. I'm coming with you.
Morris gave him a startled look. Valentinian and Anastasia started to squawk. Aid began to make some mental protest. Belisarius rode them all down.
Things have changed, he announced gaily. The battle's reaching its turning point. I have to be down there now, ready at a moment's notice to fulfill my vow to Emperor Khusrow.
Mara smiled. Valentinian and Anastasius choked down their squawks. Aid sulked.
Safe, sneered Belisarius.
He took a moment to don his armor.
Safe,
he sneered again as he began the long trek down the hill. Behind him, Morris said,
Do be a little careful, will you? Going down that miserable path, I mean. Be a bit absurd, it would, you breaking your fool neck climbing down a pile of rocks.
Safe, sneered Belisarius. 2 eager steps later, he tripped and rolled some 50 feet down the hill. When he finally came to a halt, piling up against a boulder, it took him a minute or so to clear his head. The first thing he saw dizzily was Morris leaning over him.
Safe, muttered the gray-bearded veteran morosely. It's like asking a toad not to hop.
He reached down a hand and hauled Belisarius back onto his feet.
Will you mind your step from here on? He asked very sweetly. Or must we have Anastasius carry you down like a babe in swaddling clothes?
Safe, Belisarius assured one and all, none of whom believed him for a moment. Chapter 33 Alexandria, Autumn 531 AD. Alexandria was famous throughout the Mediterranean world for the magnificence of its public thoroughfares. The 2 greatest of those boulevards, which intersected each other west of the Church of St. Michael, were each 30 yards across. The intersection itself was so large it was almost a plaza. It was marked by a tetrastylon, 4 monumental pillars standing on each corner. The buildings which fronted on the intersection were likewise impressive. On the north stood a huge church, measuring 100 yards square. The edifice was hundreds of years old. Originally built as a temple dedicated to the crocodile god Sobek, it had been converted into a Christian church well over a century earlier. Most of the pagan trappings of the temple had been discarded. The crocodile mummies in the crypts had been unceremoniously pitched into the sea, but the building itself still retained the massive style of ancient Egyptian monumental architecture. It loomed over the intersection like a small mountain. Across from it, on the south, stood a more modern building, the gymnasium which marked Greek culture everywhere in the world. And next to it, the public baths which were a hallmark of the Roman way of life. The eastern side of the intersection was taken up by another archetypal public structure, a large theater in which the city's upper crust were entertained by dramatists and musicians. Only on the west were there any private buildings, 3 stately mansions as similar as peas in a pod. Taken as a whole, the entire effect was one of grandeur and magnificence. But Antonina, studying that intersection from her vantage point atop the steps of her palace, was not impressed. She had grown up in a part of the city which was very different from the Greek aristocracy's downtown splendor. She had been born and raised in the native Egyptians' quarter, which still bore its old name of Rakotis. There, the streets were neither wide nor well paved. They were dirt alleys, which doubled as open sewers. The buildings in Rakotis were ancient only in the sense that the collapsed mud brick of one house served its successor as a cellar. There were no gymnasiums, no schools of any kind. As for public baths, she snorted, remembering. The human population density in Rakotis was bad enough. The animal population was even worse. The quarter teemed with cattle, pigs, donkeys, camels, goats, and of course the ubiquitous pigeons and their pigeon shit. The snort became an outright laugh. Zeno, standing next to her, eyed her quizzically. I was just thinking of the provisions of a typical Alexandrian rental agreement. For a house or an apartment. You know, the one about... Zeno smiled, nodding. Yes, I know. His voice took on a sing-song cadence. At the end of the term, the tenant shall return the house to the lessor free of dung. He laughed himself now. It was so embarrassing for me the first time I rented an apartment in Constantinople. I was puzzled by the absence of that provision in the contract. When I inquired, the landlord looked at me as if I were crazy or a barbarian. Antonina began to say something, but broke off. They're coming, she heard someone shout. One of the knights hospitaller, she assumed. The entire boulevard in front of her was packed with them. A 1,000 knights were arrayed there in rigid formation. They stood in lines of 20 men, covering the entire width of the boulevard and 50 lines deep. Each man carried a quarterstaff in his hand, held erect. Their only armor, as such, were leather caps reinforced by an iron strip across the forehead. The thick quilted jerkins and shoulder pads lay under the white tunics emblazoned with the red cross of their order, providing added protection against blunt weapons. And most of the knights had wound heavy linen around their forearms as well. The majority of the other knights were positioned in the various side streets debouching onto the main thoroughfare, but Zeno had crammed hundreds below the street itself. Familiar with Alexandria, the knight's commander had taken advantage of the labyrinth of cisterns which provided the great city with its water supply. If necessary, those men could either pour out onto the street from the basements of nearby houses, or they could move surreptitiously elsewhere. Zeno had 20 couriers standing nearby, ready to carry his orders when the time came. All in all, Antonina was more than satisfied with Zeno's dispositions. It remained to be seen, of course, how well the knights would do in an actual fray, but Zeno, at least, seemed fully confident of their capabilities. "There they come!" came another shout. Peering at the distant intersection, Antonina saw that a huge mob was pouring into it from the east. Within 2 minutes, the intersection itself was packed with people, and the first contingents of the crowd were advancing down the boulevard toward her palace. 10,000, I make it, murmured Zeno, not counting those who were still out of sight. As it drew near, the mob began to eddy and swirl. Seeing the stern-looking and disciplined formation of the Knights Hospitaller filling the street, not to mention the much scarier sight of armored cataphracts behind them, the faint-hearted members of the crowd began trying to get out of the front line. Pushing their way to the rear, or simply standing in one place uncertainly, they created obstacles to their more fanatical and determined compatriots. For a minute or so, Antonina even hoped that the mob would grind to a stop and retreat. But that hope vanished. Soon enough, the disparate elements which made up the huge crowd had separated themselves out. Those who were timid or vacillating or merely curious fell to the rear or pressed themselves against the walls of the various shops which lined the boulevard. The diehards surged to the fore. The great majority of them were monks, thought Antonina. It was impossible to be certain, since the custom of monks wearing distinctive habits was still in the future. The uniform of the Knights Hospitaller was another of Belisarius's innovations, but Antonina knew the breed well. Only fanatic monks, as a rule, were quite as disheveled, shaggy-maned, and just generally dirty-looking as most of the men leading the mob. And the practiced, familiar way in which they handled their clubs and cudgels reinforced her supposition. Antonina smiled ruefully, remembering Belisarius's description of a vision Aid had once given him of the monastic orders of the future, a time which would be called the Middle Ages. He described to her the good works and gentle demeanor of the Benedictines and the followers of a man who would be called St. Francis of Assisi. His Alexandria-born and bred wife had goggled at the description. The monks she knew from her youth bore as much resemblance to St. Francis as a rabid wolf to a lamb. In the Egypt of her day, the monastic orders, Orthodox and Monophysite alike, were as prone to street fighting as the thugs of the Hippodrome factions, and probably better at it. Certainly more savage. A particularly beefy monk in the very forefront of the mob caught sight of her, standing on the steps of the palace. He raised his thick club and bellowed, "Death to the Whore of Babylon!" Whether by predeliberation or simple spontaneous enthusiasm, the call was immediately taken up as the mob's war cry. "Death to the Whore! Death to the Whore!" The front lines of the mob charged the Knights Hospitaller barring the way. There was neither hesitation nor half-heartedness in that ferocious rush. The monks in the van were veteran brawlers. They had no fear whatever of the bizarrely accoutred knights, and even less of their quarterstaffs. What the hell's the use of a 6-foot-long club, anyway? No room to swing in a street fight, silly buggers. Knowing what was coming, Antonina held her breath. Quarterstaffs, too, were one of Belisarius's innovations, at least used in this manner. Shepherds' staffs were known, of course, and had featured in many a village brawl, but no one had ever placed them in the hands of an organized force who had been systematically trained in their use. When the monks were just a few feet away, the captain of the front line called the command. In unison, the 20 knights flipped their quarterstaves level and drove them into the oncoming monks like spears. Expecting club blows to the head, the monks were taken completely by surprise. The iron ferrules of the heavy quarterstaves crushed into their unguarded chests and bellies. The damage done was horrendous. Two monks died instantly, their diaphragms ruptured. Another, his sternum split and the bone fragments driven into his heart, died within seconds. The rest collapsed, tripping the ones piling up from behind. Some wailed with pain, most didn't. Broken ribs and severely lacerated bellies produced groans and hisses of agony, not loud shrieks. Instantly, the spear thrusts were followed by two quick, swirling, pivoting side blows all across the line. Iron ferrules slammed into heads and rib cages, breaking both. The captain cried out the command. Again, the stabbing quarterstaffs. Again, the scythe-like follow-on blows. A dozen more were struck down. The mob piled higher, pushing forward, floundering on fallen bodies. Some managed to force their way through the first line of knights, only to be mercilessly dealt with by the line which followed. Again, the command. Again, the spear thrusts. Some of the mob this time knew what to expect, tried to protect their midsections. The knights had expected that. This time, many of the iron-shod quarterstaff butts went into faces and heads. Skulls broke, jaws broke, teeth shattered. One throat was crushed, one neck broken. The mob staggered, eddied, hesitated. Zeno bellowed an order. Immediately, the front line of the knights swiveled and stepped back. The second line moved forward. The captain of that line used the forward momentum to drive through the next thrust savagely. The front of the mob reeled back, but only a few steps. The press from behind was too great. The monks in the very fore were trapped now, stumbling on fallen bodies, jammed up, unable to swing their own clubs, which were too short to reach the knights anyway. They were simply targets. Command, thrust, strike, strike. Command, thrust, strike, strike. Again, Zeno bellowed. The second line of knights swiveled, moved back. The third line stepped forward. Command, thrust, strike, strike. Command, thrust, strike, strike. Zeno bellowed. Third line back, fourth line up. Command, thrust, strike, strike. Command, thrust, strike, strike. Zeno was silent. The machine-like routine was established, automatic. Practiced over and again on grain ships. Now tested and proven in action. Fifth line, sixth line, seventh line. The boulevard was awash in blood. The monks, forced up by the surging mob behind them, were like sausages pressed into a meat grinder. Their frenzied club swings could only, at best, deflect the thrusting quarterstaff into the monk jammed alongside, more often than not, until the next quarterstaff drove through. Then, downed or staggering, dead often enough, crippled or maimed, or simply stunned or unconscious. As the eighth line moved forward, the great mob of monks was seized by a sudden frenzy. They had seen enough to understand that their only hope was to surge over the knights by sheer brute mass, damn the cost. Shrieking and howling, at least 200 fanatics lunged forward, trampling right over the bodies of the monks in front of them. They weren't even trying to use their cudgels now. They were simply trying to close with the knights and grapple. Anything to get through that horrible zone where the quarterstaffs reigned supreme. The surge hammered the line back. Several knights were driven down, knocked off their feet. One was seized by the ankles and dragged into the mob where he was savagely stomped to death. Another was pinioned by two monks while a third crushed his skull with three vicious cudgel blows. But this too had been foreseen. Zeno bellowed a new command. The ninth line immediately sprang forward, bracing the eighth. Both lines locked their quarterstaffs, forming a barricade across the street. The mob slammed into that barricade, pushed it back, slowly, slowly. The tenth line strode forward, drove their quarterstaffs through the gaps. Head thrusts these, there was no room for body blows. Skulls cracked, jaws shattered, noses flattened. Eyes were gouged out, teeth went flying everywhere. Thrust, thrust, thrust. Swivel, step back, 11th line forward. Thrust, thrust, thrust. The lines holding back the mob were tiring now and suffering casualties. Again, Zeno bellowed. The 12th and 13th lines stepped forward and took their place, forming the barricade. This maneuver was ragged, uneven. Switching places with a man forming a barricade is awkward, even when the man isn't bleeding and half-dazed, which many of them were. But the mob was in no position to take advantage of the momentary confusion. The monks in the fore of that mob were completely dazed and a lot bloodier. Soon enough, the hammering resumed. Standing next to Antonina, Arshot whispered, "Jesus, Son of God, Mary, Mother of Christ." Antonina's face was pale, but her stiff, cold expression never wavered. "I told you," she stated harshly. "I told you." She took a deep breath, almost a shudder. "Belisarius predicted this. He told me, he told Zeno and the Knights captains too, that if they learned to use their quarterstaffs in a disciplined and organized way, they could shatter any mob in the world, easily." Arshot shook his head. "I'm not sure the casualties in that mob are going to be much less than if we did it." "Doesn't matter, Arshot. People don't look at clubs, which is all a quarterstaff is, technically, the same way they do edged weapons. A sword or a knife is an instrument of murder, pure and simple. Whereas a club..." She smiled wryly and spread her hands in a half-comical little gesture. "Tavern brawls, casual mayhem," continued Arshot, nodding. "Not really a deadly weapon." He chuckled very grimly. "Yeah, you're right. If 1,000 monks got sabered or lanced, they'd be martyrs. But if that same 1,000 just gets the living shit beaten out of them, even if half of them die from it, people will just shrug it off. What the hell, fair fight. The monks had clubs too, and they'd never been shy about using them. Just too bad if this new bunch of monks is a lot tougher." 17th line now. "Thrust, thrust, thrust. A whole lot tougher." As the 18th line stepped forward, the mob finally broke. More accurately, the monks in the van broke. The crowd itself, the great thousands of them, had already begun edging away from the brutal battle. Edging, edging, walking, striding, running. There was room to retreat now. Once they realized it, the battered fanatics suddenly lost all their fight. Within seconds, they were running away themselves, driving the onlookers before them. Instinctively, the Knights Hospitaller began to pursue. But Zeno, without waiting for Antonina's command, bellowed again. The Knights halted immediately, stopped, leaned on their staffs, drew in deep, gasping breaths. Antonina turned to Arshot. "I want you and your cataphracts to ride through the city center. Break up into squads." She gave him a hard stare. "Don't attack anybody. Not unless you're attacked yourselves, at least. I just want you to be seen. Put the fear of God in that crowd. By nightfall, I want everyone who came out on the street today to be huddling in their villas and apartments, like mice when the cats are out." Arshot nodded. "I understand." Instantly, he trotted toward his nearby horse. She turned to Zeno. "Call out all the knights you had in reserve. Divide half of them into your..." She hesitated, fumbling for the word. "What did you decide to call that? Your 200-man groups? Battalions. Yes, that should be big enough for anything you'll face now. Send each battalion marching through the streets. The big thoroughfares only. Don't go into the side streets. And stay out of the purely residential quarters." He nodded. "We're doing the same thing as the cataphracts, scaring everybody." "Hell no," she snarled. "I want them to avoid trouble. I want you to look for it." Scowling, she pointed with her chin at the bodies of dead and unconscious monks which littered the boulevard. "Think you can recognize them? Pick them out from simple residents?" "Sure," snorted Zeno. "Look for a pack of men who'd put any mangy alley curs to shame." "Right." She took a breath. "Hunt them down, Zeno. Don't go into any side streets. I don't want to risk any ambushes in narrow quarters. And stay out of the areas where Orthodox Greek citizens live. But hunt the monks down in the main thoroughfares. It's open season today on Chalcedon fanatics. Hunt them down, bring them to bay, beat them to a pulp." She fixed him with a hot gaze. "I want it bloody, Zeno. I don't want those fucking monks huddling in their cells tonight. I want them lying in the streets. Dead,
Bruised, maimed, broken, I don't care. Just so long as they're completely terrorized.
Be a pleasure, growled Zeno. He cast a cold eye at the bloody street below. Not all of the bodies lying there were those of ultra-Orthodox Chalcedon monks. Here and there he could see a few wearing the white tunic with the red cross. Already their comrades were picking through the casualties, hoping to find one or two still alive. There wouldn't be any, Zeno knew. Not many knights had been pulled into the crowd, but those who had could not possibly have survived.
Be our pleasure, he growled again.
Then, calming himself with the breath, asked, And what of the other half? What do you want those knights to do?
They'll be coming with me, replied Antonina, along with Hermogenes and his infantry.
Where are we going?
First to the Delta Quarter. I want to see what happened there. Then, assuming that situation's under control, we'll be heading for the Beta Quarter.
She swiveled, facing Theodosius. Throughout the street battle, the new patriarch had stood quietly a few feet behind her, along with three of his deacons. His face was very pale, she saw. Wide-eyed, he and his deacons were examining the carnage on the street below. Sensing her gaze, the patriarch jerked his head away and stared at her.
What's the name of that monastery? She demanded. I know where it is, I just can't remember what the bastards call it.
Theodosius pursed his lips, hesitating. Antonina's face was as hard as steel. Her green eyes were like agates.
You know the one, Patriarch.
He looked away, sighing.
The House of St. Mark, he murmured.
Then, with a look of appeal,
Is that really necessary, Antonina?
He pointed down to the street below.
Surely you've made your point already.
I'm not in the business of making points, Theodosius, she hissed. I'm not a schoolteacher instructing unruly students.
She took three quick steps, thrusting her face into the patriarch's beard. For all her short stature, it seemed as if it was the patriarch looking up, not she.
I am the rod of authority in Alexandria. I am the axe of the empire.
She stepped back a pace, waved toward the city's main intersection.
It's good enough to simply intimidate the average Orthodox citizen. That's what a Shotanist cataphract will be doing now that the crowd has already broken up. But those...
All the pent-up hatred of a woman reviled all her life by self-proclaimed holy men erupted.
Those stinking, filthy, putrid monks are a different story altogether.
She ground her teeth, glared at the bodies lying on the street.
Whore of Babylon, is it?
When she turned back, the hot hatred was under control. Ice now. Ice. The agate eyes fixed on Zeno.
The monastery called the House of St. Mark is the largest monastery in Alexandria. It's also the center of the city's most extreme Chalcedonians. Ultra-Orthodox down to the cockroaches in the cellars. Before they made him patriarch, Paul was its abbot.
Zeno nodded.
That monastery is history, grated Antonina. By nightfall, it's nothing but rubble, and any monk who hasn't fled by the time we get there is on his way to heaven.
The hate flared up anew.
Or whatever eternity calls for him. I have my own opinion.
Zeno moved away then, rounding up his captains and explaining their new orders. Theodosius, for his part, fell back into silence. Long accustomed to the ferocious debate of a high church council, he recognized a hopeless argument when he saw one. And even if he hadn't had the benefit of that experience, he couldn't misunderstand the meaning of the phrases which, now and again in the minutes which followed, came hissing out of Antonina's mouth like steam from a volcano. As she stared at the bloody street below, her face filled with cold fury.
Whore of Babylon, is it? I'll show you the whore. Come back to my hometown, I have.
And of course, again and again,
fuck Alexandria.
When Antonina and her escort of Knights Hospitaller and Syrian infantry reached Delta Quarter by mid-afternoon, they were immediately met by Euphronius. The commander of the Theodoran cohort trotted up to her, along with Tryphiodorus, the officer whom Hermogenes had placed in charge of the grenadier's infantry support. As he peered up at the woman perched on her saddle, looking a bit like a half-broiled little lobster in her armor, the young Syrian's expression was odd, half apologetic, half accusing.
I'm sorry, he said, but
He gestured at the surrounding area. Looking up and down the street, which marked the boundary of the Jewish quarter, Antonina could see perhaps 24 bodies lying here and there. Hippodrome thugs. All blues from their garments. Killed by gunfire for the most part. Although she could see one storefront which had obviously been caved in by a grenade blast, with 3 bodies mixed in with the rubble. Her eyes scanned the roofs. 6 of the heavy wooden beams which braced the mud brick construction were festooned with hanged corpses. No more. "They ran away," complained Euphronius, "as soon as we fired the first volley." He turned, pointing to the shattered storefront. "Except that much. They tried to hole up in there. After we tossed in a couple of grenades, the 6 survivors surrendered." A self-explanatory wave at the grisly ornaments of the crossbeams. Then, apologetically, "We couldn't catch the rest. They ran too fast." Then, accusingly, "You didn't give us any cavalry."
"Can't catch routed men without cavalry," chimed in Triviodorus, the sage voice of experience. "Men running for their lives always run faster than men who were just wanting to kill them."
Sage voice of experience.
"Gotta have cavalry to really whip an enemy."
Antonina laughed, shook her head half regretfully, half ruefully. "I'll remember that." She turned her eyes to the Delta Quarter itself just across the wide thoroughfare. That side of the street was lined with Jews. Young men, mostly, armed with cudgels, knives, and the occasional sword or spear. As Hermogenes had predicted, the Jews had been quite ready to fight it out with the Hippodrome mob. Wouldn't have been the first time. But, just as obviously, the tension of the moment had passed. Even the young bravos were relaxed now, exchanging half-amicable words with Syrian grenadiers. And she could see women and children, too, here and there, as well as old folks. The children, filled with eager curiosity. The women, beginning to banter with the Syrian wives. And the old folks, of course, not for them this useless time-wasting, were already setting up their food carts and vending stalls. Life comes, life goes. Business is here today.
"Very good," Antonina murmured. "Very good."
Euphronius tried to maintain an officer's dignity, but his quiet relief at her approval was evident. She smiled down at him. "Leave 6 your grenadiers here, Hermogenes, along with Triphiodorus and his infantry, just in case. Does it look as if the Greens showed up today? Maybe that's because they usually side with the Monophysites, but maybe it's because they're just dithering. If they change their minds, I want grenadiers here to change it back." Euphronius nodded. "Meanwhile, I want you and the rest to come with me." She cocked her head, admiring the collapsed storefront. Her smile turned positively feral. "I need some demolition experts." By nightfall, the House of St. Mark was a pile of rubble. Buried beneath that mound of wooden beams and sun-dried brick were the bodies of perhaps 100 ultra-Orthodox monks. Nobody knew the exact number. From the rooftop and the windows, the monks had shrieked their defiance at the surrounding troops, vowing never to surrender. They had particularly aimed their words at the figure of the small woman in armor sitting on a horse. "We will not yield to the whore of Babylon!" And other phrases, considerably more vulgar to that effect. Antonina hadn't minded, not in the least. She would not have accepted this surrender even if it had been offered. So, cheerfully, she waited for several minutes before ordering the grenadiers into action, establishing for the public record that the monks had brought their doom onto themselves. Murmuring under her breath a gay little jingle as the grenades drove the monks into the interior of the huge monastery.
"She's back. She's back. The whore is back."
Chuckling quietly as the sappers set the charges.
"Alas, Alexandria, thy judgment has come."
Chortling aloud as the walls came tumbling down.
"How are the righteous fallen?"
Chapter 34 Antonina rose before dawn the next morning at an hour which normally found her fast asleep. But she was determined to drive through her re-establishment of imperial control without allowing the opposition a moment to regain their equilibrium. Her servants bustled about, preparing her breakfast and clothing. When the time came to don her armor, Antonina was amused by the way her maid ogled the cuirass.
"The thing's obscene, I'll admit," she chuckled.
She walked over and examined the cuirass lying on an upholstered bench against the far wall of her sleeping chamber, jutting into the air. Especially since my reputation must have grown in the telling by the time the armorer got around to shaping this mold. Firmly.
My tits are not that big.
The maid eyed her hesitantly, unsure of how to respond. The girl was new to Antonina's service. Antonina's regular maid had become ill at sea, and this girl had been hastily rounded up by her head servant Dubezes from the staff of the palace's former occupant. There had been few of that staff left when they arrived. Upon the arrival of Antonina's fleet and the destruction of the naval forces which tried to block her way into the great harbor, the former owner had fled Alexandria. He was a Greek nobleman with close ties to Paul and Ambrose's faction, and had apparently decided that discretion was the better part of valor. He would wait out the storm at his estate in far-off Oxyrhynchus. Antonina thought about that nobleman as her maid helped her into the armor. Not about him so much, she didn't even know the man's name, but about what he represented. He wasn't alone in his actions. A very large part of Alexandria's Greek nobility had done likewise. By the time she was buckling on the scabbard which held her cleaver, a task for which the maid was no use at all, she had made her decision. Two decisions, actually. Possibly three. First, there would be no repercussions against the nobles who had stepped aside and remained neutral in the battle. Not even those who had fled outright. She was simply trying to establish firm imperial control over the city. Many, most of the Orthodox Greek nobility, especially in Alexandria, would remain hostile to the dynasty no matter what she did. So long as that hostility remained muted, the thing of whispers in the salons rather than riots in the streets, she would ignore it. Second, a lesser decision flowing from the first, she would instruct Dubezes to make sure the palace was in pristine condition when she left to take up her new residence at the prefect's palace. The new prefect had been officially installed the previous evening. There had been no opposition. His predecessor, along with the deposed patriarch Paul, had fled to the military quarter at Nicopolis to take refuge with Ambrose and his army of Egypt. She snorted quietly. When the nobleman, whoever he was, eventually crept back into his palace, he would be surprised to discover it hadn't been ransacked and vandalized. The discovery wouldn't dispose him any more favorably to the imperial authority, of course, but the calm certitude behind that little act of self-discipline might help strengthen his resolve to keep his head down. Good enough. Finally, a small thing, but... She turned to her maid and examined the girl. Under that scrutiny, the maid lowered her head timidly. Egyptian, not 20 years of age. From the Fayum, I'm willing to bet. Her Greek is good, but that accent is unmistakable. What is your name? She asked.
Kutina, said the maid.
You are Monophysite? Kutina raised her eyes, startled. Antonina didn't miss the fear hidden there. She waved her hand reassuringly.
It means nothing to me, Kutina. I simply
want to know your loyalties. An Egyptian Monophysite from the Fayum. Yes. She switched from Greek to the girl's native tongue. Antonina's own Coptic was still fluent, even if her long residence in Constantinople had given it a bit of an accent.
I'll be leaving here today, Kutina. My regular maid will not recover from her illness soon. In fact, I will be sending her back to Constantinople to be with her family, so I will need a new maid. Would you like the job?
Kutina was still staring at her uncertainly. The question about her religious loyalties had obviously unsettled the girl. Paul's persecution had been savage.
I would prefer a Monophysite, Kutina.
She smiled, patting the heavy cuirass. I'm not wearing this grotesque thing for protection from heretics, you know. Kutina began to return the smile.
You are very famous, she said softly. I was frightened when you came.
Her eyes flitted to the blade buckled to Antonina's waist.
We all heard about the cleaver, even here in Alexandria.
It has never been used against any but traitors.
I know, said Kutina, nodding. Still...
Suddenly, all hesitation fled.
I would be delighted.
She was beaming now.
It would be so exciting. You're going to fight the Malwa, everyone says so. Can I come there, too?
It was Antonina's turn to be startled. She'd only intended to keep the girl in her service during her stay in Alexandria. But now, seeing the eagerness in Kutina's face, she began to reconsider. The young Egyptian was obviously not worried about the risks involved. Boredom, not danger, was the girl's lifelong enemy. It was an enemy which Antonina herself well remembered from her own girlhood. The grinding, relentless, tedious labor of a woman born into Egypt's poor masses. Kutina had probably left the Fayum seeking a better life in Alexandria, only to find that she had exchanged the toil of a peasant for the drudgery of a domestic servant. She couldn't refuse that eager face. True, the girl might find her death in Antonina's company, but she would not be bored. And besides, I need servants whose loyalty I can absolutely trust. Dubezes is not enough. I am certain the Malwa have infiltrated spies into my expedition. I must be certain they don't penetrate my own household. Kutina from the Fayum. Yes, I know that breed. The Malwa will have nothing to offer her except money. And I... She laughed. Belisarius hadn't turned over all of the fortune he garnered in India to finance Shakuntala's rebellion, nor had he given more than half of his war booty to his cataphracts. And I am richer than any Malwa spymaster. She grinned. Done, Kutina. I will pay you well, too. Much better than your former employer. Kutina's expression was an odd mixture of emotions. Pleasure at the thought of a sudden increase in wages, anger at the thought of her former employer. The man had been a cheapskate, obviously, and had combined that miserliness, Antonina was quite certain, with frequent solicitations. Kutina was pretty, as well as young. Smiling, and I won't be rattling your door latch either, late at night, trying to get into your room. That bastard, hissed Kutina. It was time to go. Time to crush a military rebellion. But Antonina had long since learned to savor all her victories, small ones as well as large. So she took the moment to exchange a warm look with her new servant, binding loyalty with her eyes far more than her purse. The maid broke the moment.
You must go, you must go,
Kutina began bustling Antonina out of the room, fussing over the scabbard which held the cleaver.
Ambrose